Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we will explore talking to space with our guest, Jean Burke. If you think about all of the satellites that have been launched to find out what the universe is like, one wonders how all of that information that they collect can come back to Earth. Jean Burke is here to tell us. Jean is a genuine rocket scientist. He holds a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and a master's degree in program management from West Coast University in Los Angeles. He has worked in aerospace for almost 50 years. At our country's most elite organization for aerospace, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, better known to some as JPL, which is operated by Caltech. Posted on my website are several images that I think you're going to want to look at while you're listening to today's show. So while you keep open the window that's accessing the audio track, open another window and click on guidetothecosmos.com. That's guidetothecosmos.com. On the home page, click on the microphone icon for a menu of radio shows and select today's show. Jean, if you worked there 50 years, you must have started even before America started its space program.
I was 12 years old.
That's great. And just before you retired, your last position there was as program manager of the Deep Space Network, which is the organization that tracks spacecraft and returns the data from these spacecraft for all of the NASA operations. Now, Jean, let me ask you to begin with, you know, since we have a lot of young listeners who aren't sure what they would like to do most in life and aren't sure how they might go about doing it, tell us what motivated you to take this sort of career path, and how was it that you managed to make yourself so successful at it?
Actually, I got started when I was in the Air Force. I got very involved with electronics and electronics world in our bomb navigation systems for Strategic Air Command. So with that, I really changed my ideas of becoming a lawyer and going into engineering. I left the Air Force and finished my education and got started with the space business. And I've got so used to it that I stayed with it all these years.
Well, that sounds great. So, Jean, tell us what this Deep Space Network really is, and tell us how it works.
Okay, the Deep Space Network is a large complex of antennas and communication links that we have in the NASA area. And there are many different styles of data that come down from the different spacecraft. We have to track the individual spacecraft, bring the data down, process the data, and send that data on to the individual users of that data. Mm. It's all done through many different antennas. And we started this way back in 1958 when we launched our first spacecraft, which was Explorer 1. At that time, Jet Propulsion Laboratory was working actually for the Army. And that went on for until NASA was formed, which was in October of 1958. And that's when the Deep Space Network got its original type of charge to implement all the different larger antennas that we have working today.
So you track the spacecraft because they keep sending signals to you, I guess, and so you aim the antenna to pick up the signal? Is that how you do it?
That's exactly right. We have a navigation system for each one of the different projects. One of them has a trajectory that we know very well from all the previous tracking and also from the preliminary predicts that we have on each spacecraft.
How many spacecraft do you think you might be tracking at any one time?
Well, throughout the period, we're tracking at least 30-some-odd different spacecraft. There's usually 15 to 20 every day, that type of numbers.
Mm-hmm. And when you say deep space, how deep does it have to be before it becomes part of this network?
Well, we were charged with by NASA to track lunar, our moon, distance, and all of the planetary, asteroid, comets, and so forth out past the moon.
I'm sorry, you also track asteroids?
Asteroids, yes, we do.
Oh, and since they're not sending you signals, how do you do that?
Well, we do that by a radar bounce, which we have out at one of our tracking facilities out on the other side of Barstow, California. It's called the Goldstone Complex. And what we do is we have a very large antenna, 70 meters, 230 feet in diameter.
Almost as big as a football field.
Yeah, it is. It is. It fits right in nicely to the Rose Bowl.
Uh-huh.
But the main features on this is that track spacecraft that are as far out as Voyager spacecraft is today, which is over 10 billion miles.
So 10 billion miles?
10 billion miles.
My gosh.
Well, yeah, at least, and it's out 100 times further than our Earth from the sun.
Voyager is at 100 astronomical units.
Yes, about somewhat over 112 AUs by the end of the month here, matter of fact.
I see. Okay. Fantastic. And so you can track the asteroids by bouncing radar beams off of them, and you track the spacecraft because they're emitting their own radio signals.
Exactly. And again, we have a very large transmitter of 500 kilowatts, which then radiates out to the individual asteroid that we're pointing at, or planet. We do a lot of radar bounces off of other planets, such as Mercury. But one of the things that we are very concentrated on is the near-Earth asteroids, which come relatively close to the Earth. So we want to make sure that we have any kind of a control of looking at those types of asteroids, and we do that by what we call a Goldstone Solar System radar system.
Okay, and we have an image on our website of one of these radio telescope dishes, and there's a nice picture of how the radio telescope dish would just fit inside the Rose Bowl, so that gives our listeners some feeling for the magnitude of these telescopes. And how many of them are there in the Deep Space Network?
Well, we have a large contingency of antennas. There are 170-meter antenna at each one of our complexes, and the complexes, again, are outside of Barstow, California, about 45 miles, and they call that Goldstone. We have another one which is outside of Canberra, Australia. And we have another complex, which is outside of Madrid, Spain.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in a low-noise type of an environment, so they're surrounded by hills and small mountains so that we can keep away from any outside radio frequency interference. We have also 34-meter antennas, which do most of the work for the DSN. And we have one each of those located in each one of those complexes. Plus, we have several others at Goldstone. We have a capacity of being able to track five different spacecrafts on five different antennas at Goldstone. In Madrid, we have three 34-meter antennas, and at Canberra, we have two 34-meter antennas. These allow us to be able to track the spacecraft for a 24-hour period if necessary, so we will never be out of contact with a spacecraft if it needs to be commanded.
Mm-hmm.
When we send commands to the spacecraft on a daily basis, sometimes continuous, where we have a transmitted uplink signal and a returned downlink signal from the spacecraft. So the spacecraft transmits a small amount of power with a large amount of data, and we receive that at our large antennas and process that data. The commanding itself is anywhere from 1 kilowatt up to 400 kilowatts as far as our high power transmitter goes.
So NASA owns all of these facilities that are in these different spots around the world that you mentioned, Spain and Australia?
NASA funds all of the different facilities as far as the building of the different antennas and all the complex equipment that goes along to support all those, specifically power generation. We have both commercial generators and commercial power that we get from the individual countries to support the different facilities.
Mm-hmm. And do you hire Spanish and Australian staff to operate these facilities, or are these mostly people from the U.S. that run them?
Well, they used to be U.S. type of contractors. Right now, we have contractors at the different complexes which are associated with the Australian contracts and also with the Spanish contract. And they, Spanish, run theirs on a standard type of basis as we do here through their NASA organization. And the same happens in Canberra in Australia for their government-run NASA type of operation.
Mm-hmm. And clearly you had to select sites around the world because as the Earth turns, you want to have at least one of the facilities that's always in a position to look in any direction of the sky wherever that spacecraft of interest might be at the moment.
That's exactly right, Robert. And we have we're approximately 120 degrees on each longitude around the globe.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the total staff of this deep space network might be?
Well, at the stations, we have different amounts of different complexes, but I would say there are approximately 100 employees at each complex.
Mm-hmm.
Plus or minus at the different locations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Different locations being they have fewer antennas or more antennas, and they have different types of work going on.
Right, right. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we are discussing how to talk to space with Jean Burke. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, You don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back, and we're discussing how to talk to space with Gene Burke. Now, you say that you handle all of the spacecraft which are at the distance of the moon and further. Do you also handle data, for instance, from the Hubble Space Telescope?
No, we don't do that type of work because that's handled through our sister center, which is the Goddard Space Flight Center located back in Greenbelt, Maryland. They have their own tracking facilities throughout the world. Most of them are located on U.S. soils, but some of them are in other countries like Svalbard and Norway.
Hmm.
We have a lot of they have a lot of antennas up in Alaska that they use.
Hmm.
Also in Hawaii.
Hmm. But something like the Cassini mission to Saturn, that would be a satellite that you guys would track and bring the data back?
Most definitely. Cassini was launched in 1997. It went into orbit in 2004 around Saturn. One of its major mission events was to launch a probe into Titan, which is Saturn's largest moon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done successfully. The spacecraft is still orbiting Saturn, bringing back images mainly of several of the moons, but also all of the rings that they encounter throughout their travel.
Yeah, spectacular pictures, as I think most people have seen. And so it's taking pictures essentially all the time, I imagine.
And it is. That they are concentrating on their imaging systems. They bring that data back, that's when the DSN picks up that information, bringing back the telemetry, transmitting commands, mm-hmm. and bringing back that specific data to the individual projects, which can be located anywhere in our world. We have scientists which are involved with the individual spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
One of them talking about Cassini, we have project scientists located back in the Flight Physics Lab in Maryland. We have physicists over in a lot of the different universities, of course, because that's where their experiments began. And so all the data goes back to those individual types of experimenters and the principal investigators.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get the data to them? Is that by satellite link or just over phone lines or...?
Several different ways, one of them being satellite communication. That's our biggest travel and communication function.
Mm-hmm.
The other one being landlines. We have large, high-rate type of landlines that we contract through regular type of communication companies like AT&T. We have large bundled type of data that we also send out through the Internet, going to individual type of experimenters. So there's a lot of different ways that we can communicate.
Hmm. And you said that the number of satellites that you might be tracking at any given time could be 20 or more?
It could. And where we're tracking one station, we have probably about 12 to 15 different stations that we use on a daily basis, and then other times we use other antennas in different facilities that are not associated with DSN, but they are associated with data that is coming down. For instance, some weather data that is coming down from one of our satellites, which goes directly to our National Weather Service. And although we're controlling a spacecraft, they also have data which comes down and can be picked off at other facilities and their antennas.
Is there ever any dispute over who gets the antenna time?
a lot. We have a negotiation process, and actually that's what I was the program manager on, which has to do with the resource allocation process, as we call it. And we have weekly meetings to determine long-range plans and mid-range plans and short-range plans. Mainly the weekly meetings are short-range, having to go out about 6 to 8 weeks. And we determine which spacecraft has to have what size antenna, which spacecrafts are in the same view period, and then we try to move those different projects onto the different antennas that are capable of processing their data. But we have a lot of instances when we have two or three different spacecrafts that need to have that data at the same time. So we have, and we're looking at the same antenna, therefore we can't process more than one at a time, usually. Mm-hmm. So what we will do then is we will sort of what we call divvy up the capabilities that we do have and the capacity of the antennas.
So if you had two scientific groups associated with two spacecraft that had to use the same antenna, and they both claim that their data is more important than the other guy's data, then you're the guy who sort of has to arm wrestle this down so that they both get their absolute requirements fulfilled, and maybe they don't get everything they want, huh?
That's exactly right. You got it perfect. The idea is that we try to give as each mission as much time as we possibly can, and we have to divvy up that time between the different projects. If the projects have to have that specific type of data, then we'll go to another antenna and negotiate that with whoever is scheduled to have that time at that other antenna. And usually we will be able to come to an agreement of who will get those specific antennas. Mm-hmm. We can't get to a agreement, then we will go up a chain, which is a standard process that we use, and we will discuss that with the individual project managers, the individual project scientists, and if it's between different centers like Jeffrey Postman Laboratory and John Hopkins University or Harvard University, who also has different spacecraft that they control, then we will go to their senior management.
Now, and I take it that these antenna are run on a pretty much of a 24/7 basis, huh?
Well, they certainly are. Yeah. Our main control room is located at Jeffrey Postman Laboratory in Pasadena. And we have a continuous operation of controllers, not only controlling the different antennas at the different complexes and working with the contractors that are at those specific complexes, but also the individual projects themselves have their own control centers, whether it be at JPL, at Goddard Space Flight Center, at European Space Operations Center in Darmstadt, Germany. So we're all over the world, including Japanese Space Agency, Canadian Space Agency, and even have workings with the Russian Space Agency.
Ah, I see. So do you track only NASA satellites, or do you also track other satellites?
Well, we do track other spacecraft. Those are mainly having to do with our National Weather Service. They're spacecrafts, which are geocentric type of operational Earth satellites. They're located throughout our world, so we can get weather reports throughout. So we are some of the only antennas located in the specific areas that they need coverage on.
Mm-hmm.
So we track all their spacecraft most of the time. They have their own facility that also tracks their spacecraft.
So the geocentric satellites are the ones that are always in the same place in the sky above the Earth because they orbit the Earth every 24 hours. Did I get that right?
They're synchronous to, yeah, so it goes around 24 hours and they're still at the same place,
mm-hmm.
basically looking in the same area as far as their span of our weather information goes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you see on the nightly news.
Mm-hmm. Do you also track the satellites of other countries?
We do. We mentioned the European Space Agency. We have a lot of different cooperative projects and missions that we track, mainly because we have instruments on their spacecraft or they have instruments on our spacecraft. So we transfer a lot of data back and forth between our different countries, European Space Agency, German Space Agency, Japanese Space Agency, and again, also the Canadian Space Agency. So we do a lot of work with those different types of countries.
Sounds like it's an exciting endeavor.
It is. It's very it's a very difficult job at sometimes, but it is very interesting to be able to track those types of spacecraft and return that data to the scientists who are the ones who are mainly interested in that data that coming down for their own specific experiments. Of course, the controllers of the spacecraft have to have that information for all the engineering. For instance, the ones who are still roving on Mars, which is Spirit and Opportunity, they have daily contacts with those rovers, and they program them to command different functions and different ways of traveling from one point to another, or in one to one rock to another, as it may be.
Mm-hmm. Well, since the entire purpose of putting things out into space is to find out what's there, that whole effort really hinges on all that information coming back to Earth through the Deep Space Network, doesn't it?
It does. And there's a lot of different ways that the information is passed back and forth, one of them being that the data itself, for instance, the telemetry has different coding techniques to be able to send a high rate of data back to the Earth so that they can get the correct information in the highest rate that they possibly can. And then it returns to Earth and where they decode all that type of data. And then that decoded data is sent to the experimenters.
Hmm. Amazing stuff. Well, that's great. Gene, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Join us again next week when we will explore green energy and novel ways to achieve it with our guest, Dr. Lewis Larson, president of Lattice Energy. Thank you for tuning in, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.